Dr. Andrew Bell, who's in studio from the Chicago Botanic Garden. Are you technically an arborist or a scientist?
I would say a scientist, yes.
Okay.
Yep. Botanist.
And sitting next to him, Pat Etherington from The Care Trees, a Davey company and a great sponsor of the Mike Novak Show. You are a certified arborist.
I am a certified arborist.
Okay.
Which makes me half scientist, half artist. So,
you know, that's a really good way of putting that, because in dealing with trees, so much of it is art as well as science. And even the way we perceive trees. I think a lot of folks, they take it too far because they sometimes forget trees are living things. But I think a lot of folks look at trees as art, as living art, which is not a bad way to look at a tree. As long as you're willing to preserve your art, that's the key. And to preserve your living art, you need to water it and feed it and put it in the right circumstances and the situation. And that's why we're here, because Dr. Bell has been working on a study and creating an adaptive tree planting list. And basically, it's which trees are going to survive the rest of this century and into the future as climate change. And if you were catching any of the show before you came on in the 9 o'clock hour, especially when Rick DeMaio, our meteorologist, is on, who studies that and teaches climate change. And we're talking about alternative energy to mitigate climate change. And it's all interconnected. It's one of the things that I have found over the years as a radio host of this kind of show. I started as a gardener. Okay, let's talk gardening stuff. You cannot divorce that from the rest of what's going on around us. Mm-hmm. Especially when you talk about trees, oxygen, producing oxygen and taking carbon dioxide and just the inputs we have into our soils, whether it's water or chemicals or fertilizers, whatever we put, it's all interconnected. And that's the thing. And that's what I love about this job. That's absolutely what I love about this job. So, Dr. Bell, let's start with you. Why? Got you going on this study? How did this whole thing begin?
A couple years ago, I was working with the city of Chicago on a task force that was put together under Mayor Daley's administration. And we were developing a plan to preserve the existing urban forest here in Chicago.
What was that called again?
The Chicago Trees Initiative.
Right. It's just not there anymore, is it? It just sort of
gone dormant.
New administration and
different priorities.
And sure. I will say it. It's a shame. I liked the Chicago Tree Initiative. But continue.
Yeah. So we were doing some great work looking at how to protect the current urban forest, but also how to expand it. And in the process of this work, we were talking about, you know, where we should be planting trees, what trees should we be planting. And at the same time, we were having conversations about climate change, but never having those conversations together. And people kept asking, well, what should we be planting today that will continue to not only survive, but thrive in a changing climate? And no one had a really good answer for that. And I knew my colleagues at the Botanic Garden were using climate change models to look at how species in their native habitats would respond and which areas they would continue to survive in the future with the effects of climate change. And so I spoke to them about, could we use those same models to look at trees in a cultivated setting? And they said, absolutely. So we, over the past 2 years, have been modeling species that are on the City of Chicago's urban tree planting list. We looked at 2020, 2050, and 2080 were the 3 decades that we looked at into the future.
How does one do that?
Did you have a temperature base? Do you change your watering out to 2080?
Right. So it's all based on predictive climate models, which are, widely available. Scientists are using them in all number of different disciplines, the various climate models that are out there. But yes, it is based on predictive changes in temperature and precipitation into the future.
Mm-hmm.
It's basically like weather models, how we get our forecast 3 and 4 days out, but we're looking decades out.
And you were also using the intergovernmental studies, right?
Yes, that's the organization that worked together to develop the climate models for each of these future decades.
You know, I have to make this statement because it struck me as I was putting this show together. that here we are at the Chicago Botanic Garden, and you're looking into the future and saying, okay, things are going to change, so we'd better be prepared for this change. You wouldn't do that if you thought that the intergovernmental agency was blowing smoke, okay, and just and creating stuff out of whole cloth. And yet, the report's going to come out in a few days, and it's going to be debunked in some circles, and it's going to be made fun of. And yet, we've got institutions like the Chicago Botanic Garden, which is not a small organization and an insignificant one. You're already making plans for the future and saying, no, this, we really need to pay attention to that. Meanwhile, we've got a whole category of people creating obfuscation and lying and being disingenuous and just anything you can to divert the discussion while people like you are already planning for the future. And I don't understand how the public cannot look at that and say, I'll put my money with the Chicago Botanic Garden because they're a scientific organization. And they've already, they say that the jury is in. And we know that things are changing and we have to adapt.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, we all run into skeptics, climate skeptics out there. And so it was important for me to be able to address that. So the list that we've developed, and it's not really that we developed it, we took the city of Chicago's current urban tree planting list and modeled those species. So everything on our list is currently recommended for planting in Chicago. So if nothing happens, nothing changes whatsoever with the climate, you'll be fine. So we're not recommending that you plant palm trees or things that we currently don't grow here.
Aw, rats. So, I was
done. Yeah. Oh, come on. I want a monkey puzzle tree on right. my block.
I want coconut. My own little coconut.
That's right outside your window, right?
Right.
So you can just lean out and pick coconuts
yep.
whenever you need them. Well, that's a really good point as well.
So I think what we really wanted to get to was these are the ones that you should not be planting that's currently recommended for planting here because mm-hmm. the models suggest or predict that they will not perform well in the future.
But
so
you
some didn't survive.
Yes. We were able to do 50, and of the 50, 10 did not perform on the model.
All right, what are those, the dirty 10?
Dirty 10.
Yeah.
I won't read them all off, but it was a...
Well, it's only 10, come on.
Shagbark hickory, katsura tree, macchia, ironwood, Norway spruce, Black Hill spruce, Serbian spruce, the sargent cherry, and then the native linden tree, and the little leaf linden tree. So two species
wow.
of tilia.
Now, wait a second. Okay, there's a lot, just by you naming that list... It's a lot of things that pop up. First of all, I was at an event yesterday, the Frederick Law Olmsted event in Riverside. Mm-hmm. Ran into an arborist and some garden writers, and they knew all about you and they knew about your study, which is good. But the question was, why hickory? Why ironwood? You know, they were kind of curious and I think a little skeptical.
Mm-hmm.
So explain your reasoning in that regard.
Well, I can't explain the results that come out of computer models, but I would...
Oh, sure you can.
I can try to, but no, I was actually talking to Patrick just before we came in here and said the shagbark hickory was one that surprised me that it did.
Apparently it surprised other people too.
Mm-hmm. And so I am in their camp as well. So these are predictive models. They may not be completely accurate, but I think this is a starting point for this type of research. As I mentioned before, other people have used climate models to look at plants in their native habitats. But to the best of my knowledge, no one's done that in a cultivated setting.
Mm-hmm.
And we would like to continue this research and get more data points to have a stronger model, stronger results. And maybe that would change the outcomes. Maybe it would not. But yes, shagbark hickory was a surprise.
And are there other hickories that would do well?
That's the only one that we did.
Okay.
Again, it takes a long time to do this modeling.
And you're going to continue to do this, and I imagine you will update this as you move forward.
As funding is available. We're working on that right now.
It's always about the funding, isn't it?
I have my day job, and it's much more than just this. So yes, we'd like to continue it.
What is your day job?
I'm the curator at the Chicago Botanic Garden.
Oh, day job. I thought maybe you were an entertainer or something.
Research is a small part of
and
my
that's,
appointment.
That's a really good point that you are the curator of woody plants
mm-hmm.
at the Chicago Botanic Garden. Thank you for bringing that up. By the way, that is Dr. Andrew Bell, and he's in studio here. And if you have a question about the kinds of trees that you might want to choose looking forward, looking at 2050, which is the early. And as you move forward, you know, to 2080 or 2100, it's got to get harder and harder to kind of really know what's going to happen. 2050, I would think, is fairly predictable, but even that is, you know, that's a ways away.
Well, for 2080, the results were so depressing, and then we also know that trees in an urban setting rarely live beyond 40 years anyway, so it's almost like, let's don't talk about 2080 because it's depressing what the models show, the results. And
well, now you just can't drop that bomb and walk away from it. Tell me what, and pull that microphone just a little bit closer. I'm going to ask you to do that. What were you seeing in 2080?
For 2080, only 10 of the 50 species maintained 50% of their climatic suitability here.
Oh, my goodness.
So
10?
Only 10.
Wow. See, and this is the scary stuff that we look at when I'm doing some of the climate stuff, because talking to, you know, as we look at, you know, you think of a tree as being, you know, fairly strong and sturdy. You know, they're this infrastructure that, you know, is a tree. What about more fragile plants like, I don't know, food? And how are those going to respond to changing climate?
Yeah.
We have to get smart.
Did I give the phone number? I don't know if I did. 773-763-9278. 773-763-9278. Yes, Lisa?
It looks like we have a caller on hold.
Okay. We will get to that in just a second. But I wanted to talk about, you divide the category of trees. Categories of trees into legacy trees, and I don't have it all right in front of me, but it's like there's three. There's the ones that you think are going to live 60 years or longer or something, and then the ones that are in yards and parks, and then there are the ones that are in the sidewalks and as decoration. And I'll be honest with you, when I read that, I thought, why are you even including those trees? Because they die so quickly when, you know, they're in what we call tree pits. And some tree pits have soil in them. Some people are, you know, try to actually help those trees survive. Some tree pits are just surrounded by concrete. And the root ball is there, and whatever sustenance the tree can get out of that root ball, and it's usually, what, about 7 to 13 years worth, something like that? Right. Yeah, because those trees die very quickly. So my feeling is, why would you even include those trees in your study? Because they're short-term trees anyway. They're going to die quickly.
They are, but I think there are certainly situations where they survive longer than that, where you have higher levels of maintenance being given to these trees. That
yeah, some people do.
Right.
Yeah. But we all know, I'll go by institutions that I frequent, like my bank. Okay. That's got trees and tree pits outside. And sometimes I just want to say, have you guys watered that lately? You know, watered those trees? Did you just let them sit there? Because again, this goes back to what we said at the top of the hour, which is a lot of people treat trees as art, and they fail to realize that a tree in a tree pit like that is not getting any nourishment. It's not getting any water. It's not going to survive unless you help it along a little bit. And if you like what's there, and it's often a honey locust or something like that, or a ginkgo, you know, it's going to be gone. And so you have to take that into consideration as well. But like I'm saying, it's my feeling is that we got to pay attention to the trees that actually have a chance of living.
Right.
And that's kind of what you're doing here. So talk about the legacy trees a little bit. Do you see a decline in trees that we've already had? Let's say we've got trees now that are 50, 60 years old, and we're trying to get them to go to, you know, 120 years old. Is that going to happen, or will climate change affect those as well?
I definitely think it will affect those as well.
So we might lose some of our old, beautiful trees that have become icons simply because, even if we're taking care of them, it's the climate itself is going to do the damage?
I think if they're in a residential planting, they probably would fare a little bit better if they're being cared for. Trees already have a number of stresses on them in the urban environment, and then climate change is going to add one more stressor to that, and that may be the tipping point for many of them.
You know, one of your, Pat Etherington from the Care of Trees is also here. one of your colleagues, Sean Kingzett, often says to me, he says, there's no such thing as normal soil in an urban or suburban setting. And I think he's right. And that's part of the deal here, too, is that, as you said, Dr. Bell, trees are stressed to begin with. And that's because the soil has been altered so many ways and continues to be altered and affected by all the different things that we have in the city, runoff and chemicals that we use in the past, lead, which is not so much an issue, and just on and on and on. Let's take some phone calls, 773-763-9278. I've got more questions for you, but I want my listeners to be able to get involved. And let's go first to Dave in Madison. Good morning, Dave.
Hey, Mike. Another great show. It's very, very important. And I have a quick question. With regards to the recommended versus non-recommended trees for future adaptation to climate change, I'm wondering if it might be a mistake to not continue to plant natives with genetic diversity in the same time planting those that we may have a higher confidence that will survive, because to me, part of the adaptation issue is to make sure we have that genetic diversity for the adaptive flexibility over time. And so even with like the emerald ash borer, if we go in and cut all the ash down first, we lose any chance of having a genetic resistance that might be in one or two strains or individual trees. So I'm wondering, maybe an idea, if you could comment on this, is not only to plant those that are recommended, but to continue to plant natives that we may get worried about, but at least have that as sort of a hedging of our bets.
You know, that's such a good question, Dave, because that was going to be one of my next questions. And
that's why it's good.
Yeah. Exactly. But you kind of preempted me on that. But that's what I was thinking, too, is that a number of the trees that you suggest, you're looking at survivability.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily are they native to the area, and if the climate changes, it doesn't really matter if they're native, because if that climate changes, even the native trees won't survive. But Dave's point is well taken, is we have to preserve the genetic history of these trees, and how do you take that into account?
Mm-hmm. Well, we weren't suggesting that not to plant natives, so mm-hmm. I don't think that's at all what we're suggesting, but and I think it gets back to the genetic diversity that exists within the native plants. Like, I remember reading in an article in the Chicago Tribune, someone said that the white oak tree, which is the state tree of Illinois, will no longer grow here in the future. And I don't know that I necessarily believe that, given that its, you know, native range extends all the way to the deep south, to northern Florida. So the native plants, they're probably going to shift northward, their native distribution ranges.
Mm-hmm.
But I think many of them will continue to grow well here in the Illinois area, Chicago area.
Hey, one other quick thing, Mike, just to ask a question. With regards to the natives versus non-natives and in some of these urban areas, is it good to fertilize them or not? And I'll hang up and listen, and thanks, you guys. Great show.
All right. Thanks, Dave. Always a pleasure hearing from you. Dr. Bell?
I think it's a good question for Patrick.
Okay, well, let's drag Patrick Etherington into this from the Care of Trees.
Fertilization is kind of a nebulous term. I mean, what are you trying to, it's always good to supplement, especially urban trees, because we've taken away, a lot of times trees try and fertilize and mulch themselves every fall, and we just pull that out from underneath them and put down things that favor turf.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, if by fertilizing you mean improving the soil, the nutrients that should be there for the tree, including the organic matter, then I think mulching is a key component to caring for any tree in an urban setting. I think a lot of times, like Mike said, you got a tree out in front of his bank that's been sitting in a poor planter, and it's not going to just make it on its own. So it may need some supplementing as it pulls nutrients out of the soil that it's growing in that aren't replaced. So I think fertilizing is important, but what are you looking to replace? You know, which nutrients, which organic compounds? So I'm going to say yes to the fertilizing, but with that caveat.
You know, it seems that that's the first place people go when they have problems, issues with their plants. They say, and especially trees for some reason, and I've never quite understood that. Folks say, my tree's in decline. Should I fertilize? And I always say, well, what are the symptoms? What are you? And I'm sure, Pat, you do the same thing on the job.
Yeah, why is the tree declining? You know, if it is nutrients, then supplementing it might help it. But if it's declining for lack of water or being too deep in the soil or being upset that we put a new house in 5 feet away from it, then fertilize.
It's sulking because you put in a new house. It took away half the root system.
Right. So it may need to do some things to help itself out before that fertilizing is going to be a real benefit to it. So
773-763-9278 is our telephone number. Let's go back to the phones. And Chris, you're on the Mike Novak Show. Good morning.
Good morning, everyone. I have a question for both gentlemen. As I'm sure you know, the suburbs are cutting down hundreds of thousands, maybe even millions of ash tree. I think Arlington Heights alone is cutting down like 10,000. What should they be planting in their place?
And I guess that's what this study is all about, right? Yeah. You know, but I'm glad you brought that up because I didn't go to that right away, Chris. But it's so, to me, it's so disturbing that that's our recourse. This is what we're doing. We are, you know, the ash tree is going to end up like the American chestnut, basically. There's going to be a few stands of mature trees. There's going to be, you know, a handful of them. Unless we find a way to defeat the emerald ash borer, which people are working feverishly to do right now. But it doesn't look good right now. And to have municipalities just chopping down these trees because they're preparing for the future, too. They want trees there, so they have to plant something else. It's heartbreaking is what it is. So let's get back to the question, and that is, what do you plant instead? But that's what your research has been all about.
Absolutely, and I think the short answer there is diversity. We didn't learn our lesson the first time around with the American elm, which was planted in great numbers in many urban areas in the U.S., and with the Dutch elm disease came in and wiped that out. We came back and pretty much planted with ash, and now currently the city of Chicago has 11% of its tree canopy is ash, so we're going to have many holes throughout the city.
Do you think we're actually going to learn the lesson this time? Or because I'll tell you right now, there's so many honey locusts in the city. You think all we need is for some disease, some insect to come along that doesn't like honey locusts, and now we'll lose all those trees as well.
My whole street would be done.
Yeah, well, but that's the problem.
Every tree on my street
should not be a honey locust. You know, and you guys...
Well, the right mixture? Because 10% sounds diverse to me. What is the right mixture?
How many different kinds of trees are there the United States? All right. And to have 10, one out of 10, to be that one species is I wish I could find it. There's a rule of thumb about
30,
plant.
20, 10.
The what?
I think it's 30-20-10.
Are you familiar with that, either of you guys? I've used it on the show, and it's about which trees should be in different species and which should be in different cultivars. And I have to go look it up to find it. But
I'll find it for
us. All right, great. Thank you.
And one quick other question, if I could.
Sure.
What is the future, do you think, of our nice oak forests, like, you know, that we have in the forest preserves up here in the northern suburbs? And in fact, the oak forest that you have at the Botanic Gardens.
Hmm. Good question. I don't know. I think it's a really good question for one of the ecologists that we have at the Botanic Garden.
Passing the buck, huh?
Yes, I am.
Well, on a related note, because I notice as I'm driving, you know, up to the suburbs to see my family, just an increase of the number of, it seems like just more tree falls. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if I've just never noticed as many trees, you know, just fallen in the forest preserves. I rode Saturday through Cook County Forest Preserves.
But if nobody heard it or saw it, it doesn't. It really didn't happen. Right. Okay, sorry.
But I'm just curious about that. So did we answer the first question of what are we replacing the ash trees with?
Well, diversity. One of the rules of thumb is, and I use this when I do commercials for the care of trees, see what your neighbor's growing and plant something else. You know, and it's true. I mean, you might like it, but there's plenty of other trees out there that are going to be as good or better than what your neighbor has, especially if it's your neighbor has a Norway maple. Okay. It's my prejudice there. Let me ask you about Norway maple. I'm going to let you go, Chris.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks for calling. I appreciate that. Let me ask you about that. And then Rick DeMaio called, and he's got a question. Get to him in just a second. What about Norway maples and trees like that? Are they tough trees? Are they going to survive climate change? And if so, do we really have to plant them? Because I hate them.
Right. Well, they are tough trees. They do very well here. Very tolerant of urban landscape conditions.
Yeah.
But we know they are becoming invasive in certain areas of the country and potentially around here. And so it's not a tree that we recommend planting. It's actually on our invasive plant list at the Chicago Botanic Garden.
Yay.
But it's still a popular tree with the industry.
Is it really? Are they still planting those things?
I don't think so many homeowners are, but I certainly see people plant. They're certainly being grown by nurseries, and you see them listed in catalogs.
All right, let me ask the nursery business, the nursery industry, what the hell are you doing? What is wrong with you?
I think they're filling a need, or you know, we have a limited palette of plants we can use in an urban setting that'll do well. And most people's yards is not an oak woodland to be preserved. And if they want a tree that they can put in the ground and it'll grow kind of regardless of what happens, then Norway maple comes up. And so it gets planted because it does all right. Ecologically, no, it's a mess. But
yeah. What about silver maple?
I like silver maple, actually.
Sarah's giving silver maple a thumbs down. Thumbs down. Pull that mic over, Sarah.
It's the helicopters and the gutters.
And Pat, do you have an opinion about silver maple since we're all weighing in here?
Silver maple's a good tree, but it's a high-maintenance tree.
It is. It has some issues.
And to be fair, I get upset with people who are unwilling to do any maintenance. You know, who just want their world to be maintenance free, and it's like, no, that doesn't. And so they don't plant the female cultivars of anything because, oh my gosh, if it has fruit, oh, that's so messy. Oh, we can't deal with it. Meanwhile, we're sending off all this pollen from the males. Mm-hmm. You know, so what do you, and we have skyrocketing asthma in the country. And I, you know, Tom Ogren, and I've talked about him before. He's a researcher who thinks that's connected. And I agree.
I think it's interesting because those male trees are all planted at schools.
Yeah. We have pollen corridors outside of schools and hospitals as well. It's insane.
But I think with the ginkgo, that's one tree that you have to be sexist with, you know.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, you don't want the female ginkgo. And interestingly, you do the study. And if you go to my website, mikenovak.net, go to this week's show, I put a lot of the links from the Chicago Botanic Garden, including the comparison between the American linden and the, which variety of ginkgo is that?
Autumn gold.
Yes, autumn gold. The American linden, native tree, it's not going to fare well here. The ginkgo, much better. Mm-hmm. Now, the ginkgo might have been native 100,000 years ago, 100 million years ago. Sorry, 100 million years ago. We don't know. It's basically not native to anything anymore, which is kind of weird. It's a gymnosperm. Mm-hmm. It is basically a deciduous conifer. Drops its leaves. And you can tell just by looking at the leaves, it doesn't look like any other tree out there.
The ginkgo?
Yeah. It's a relic from when the planet was very, very different. It's actually kind of cool.
And it was one of the best performers in the study.
That's what I said. Yeah.
Which explains why it's been here for 100 millions of years. It's survived everything.
Yeah.
So right. I know there's links on,
Oh, no, go ahead.
I was going to say, I know there's links on the Mike Novak page, but I'm going to also link through from Facebook. I'm completely loving I'm embarrassed to say I've never been to the Chicago Botanic Gardens website, and particularly the section on trees and this study that you conducted. This is really cool website. I know nothing about trees, and now I feel so smart.
Let's take Rick's call, and then we will need to break. Meteorologist Rick DeMaio is back. How you doing, Rick?
Good.
I missed you.
Long-time listener, first-time caller, Mike.
Oh, cool.
do you guys, and Andrew and Pat, fascinating and very stimulating conversation. Do you guys remember the movie The Day After back in 1983?
No.
No, I don't.
I do.
Mike, you remember that. Do you want to explain to them what that movie was about?
There's a lot of movies with similar. I think, is that the nuclear one?
Yeah, that was the one that actually was broadcast nationwide on, well, not nationwide, but by all the networks.
Yeah.
I think there was a Q&A before and after with Ted Koppel. I would like to have a movie called The Day After, and it basically represents what our landscape would look like without any trees.
Ooh. Ooh. Yeah.
And I would really like to see something like that. I know we've had some weird sci-fi movies in the past, but this one may actually get the point across. Now, my question to you, Andrew, is this. As a meteorologist, we oftentimes have to explain the difference between weather and climate to people. I think we've done a pretty good job of that. However, what we've seen, though, in the last probably 5 to 10 years is the difference within climate, which is climate change and climate variability. And we often note that there is a certain forcing mechanism that change produces higher degrees of variability. And the higher degrees of variability are much more difficult to predict in a long-term climate model because of all these internal feedbacks. And I know you've probably have scratched your head many times, Andrew, on the results of some climate models. And there's been some climate models in the past that have some decent, you know, results and some that don't. And that's why we have all this discussion about it. But I think that's one of the things that we really need to get across to people is, as someone on the forefront or the front line, so to say, of meteorology, people just say, well, just tell me what's going to happen. And we often try to do that with climate models. Mm-hmm. And I think what we need to do with climate models is not tell them what the change is going to be, but what the variability is going to be. Because in the end, the variability turns out to be the weather. So in a sense, we're doing everything in reverse. Like this summer, Mike asked me at the beginning of the year, what's the summer going to be like? And I've learned through experience that you can't predict what the summer is going to be like. You can predict what the summer is going to behave like at the beginning, middle, and the end. And I think if Dave up in Madison is listening to me, he's probably shaking his head yes, because at the beginning of the year, it was extremely wet. All of a sudden, within the last couple of weeks, we were going back into a drought in southern Wisconsin. And just this past Wednesday, people on the intersection of Midvale Road and University Avenue were driving with water up to their bumpers as 3 inches of rain came down. And we seem to see more and more of this variability. So how do we get that information to the public, particularly with the fact that the Botanic Gardens now has such a fantastic place for people to learn more about climate?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you're making a good point about the variability in weather patterns. And I think that's a good reason that one of the reasons we've tried to move away from the term global warming, because the public just thinks, oh, well, it's going to be hot all the time, and use the term climate change more, because with the warming with a warming climate, you're going to see more variability in wet weather patterns. So I think it's a really good point that with climate change, it's just more variability in wet weather events.
And I think as Mike has pointed out, and I've seen this many times, Mike, and this was when I was working for Fox, they were putting a whole new stretch of trees on Clark Street from Montrose all the way up to Andersonville. And the guy goes, hey, you work for Fox, right? I'm like, yeah. He goes, I want Walter Jacobson to come out here and measure the diameter of this tree and this root ball and tell the city of Chicago that these trees are not going to last. And I mentioned it to Walter, and he said, well, why does anybody really care about trees? But you know what? I think if this was now, Walter would probably do that story and do a really good story, Mike, about why those trees most likely don't have a survival rate of more than 2 to 4 years. It's because of the extreme variability and the lack of probably proper care after they're planted.
Yeah, or lack of care in planting, Pat.
That too.
And that's what we're going to get to. Rick, excellent points. Thank you so much for listening and coming back and calling in.
And very stimulating show, Mike. You are the best, without a doubt.
No, you are the best. I'll talk.
No, you are the best.
All right, you're right. I am.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye. Pat, your turn, buddy. Sidle up to the mic. What are people doing wrong when they plant trees? Give me the biggest mistake you see.
I think the biggest mistake just ties into what we were just talking about and is not getting the right tree in the right spot, and then you're setting it up to fail. So that's probably the biggest mistake.
Okay, that's a very broad category. How are ways that people do this wrong, put the wrong tree? Now, obviously, size, you don't count on a tree that's going to be 80 feet tall and you plant it, you know, 2 feet from the house. You got a problem, right?
Sure. How are you going to use the area around the tree? I mean, the helicopters is a good example. You shouldn't probably park the silver maple next to your house. You know, what do you want the tree to do? Do you want it to be, flower and look pretty? Do you want it to provide shade? So what are your goals for the tree? Is it fall color you're looking for? Those are the things you have to consider. And then once you figure what you want your tree to do for you, then start looking at places like the Botanic Garden and get on their website and figure out trees that'll meet those criteria, whether it's shade or flowers or fall color or all of the above or screening, and see. And they do a real good job of indicating what trees might grow. Is the site, then you got to look at the site. Is it wet site? Is it a dry site? Is it an exposed site? And marry those things, you know, you get the right tree and meet the site conditions, what we call microclimates. Those are probably the two most important things. And then actually just the mechanics of the planting, you know, get it planted right, plant it at the right time of year.
All right, that's the stop right there. Fall is a good time, at least now we're early fall, which starts today. Good time to plant some trees, but not all trees.
Correct.
What trees would you not advise? Maybe this is an easier way to do it. What would you not plant at this time of year?
It's tough to answer specifically. I might stay away from oaks unless they, you know, were dug earlier and bald and burlapped and taken care of over the summer. Some of the conifers I wouldn't push too late into the fall. Some of the evergreens.
Yeah, because I've heard that before too. The conifers. This isn't. But you're saying that right now, it's kind of, this is still early enough where the ground's going to stay warm and the root systems are going to get out. And especially, I imagine, especially if you protect it, you mulch it properly going into the winter and keep it hydrated. And that's a key too, because, all right, yeah, we had some good rains this week, but they were scattered. Not everybody got the rain that I got in my backyard. You know, not everybody's basement got flooded. And that's part of the problem is that folks see that and they think, oh, I'm covered. But we've been in a dry couple of months.
The last six, I think, have been, or the last 6 weeks have been like fourth or fifth driest on record. So you do have to pay attention to those things. It's a, you know, these are living organisms. And what's the local weather doing? And you're right, Mike, the rains have been really spotty all summer. Mm-hmm. Hadn't like the whole Chicago area been hit evenly. So you need to see what your local area got. So if your trees aren't getting, you know, an inch of water a week during the growing season, then you may need to be supplementing. And fall, you still need to keep the soils moist going into fall, especially with the evergreens and the conifers. They're still actually actively photosynthesizing and pulling water out of the soil. So that's true.
Yeah, I think folks don't understand just how late into the season the tree continues to, well, and if the ground's not frozen, there's always activity going on in the root system, right?
I think the
Dr. Bell's nodding too.
Yeah. I think the cutoff's about 40 degrees. It's still pretty active as long as the soil temperature is 40 or higher. And the soil stays warmer than the air conditions later in the year. So,
well, can we take a couple more phone calls here? And as you come up with ideas for planting, and I got some questions for you now too, but I want to get to some of these. Let's go to Ron, who's been holding on for a while. Ron, you're on the Mike Novak Show. Good morning.
Hi, Mike. Hi, Dr.
Bell
and Pat. I live in Fossmoor on about a third of an acre lot. We've got about a dozen or more trees, and they're very mature. We've been here 35 years, and more than half of them were here when we started. So they're mature. In the past couple of years, I mean, they're diversified, too. You know, there's a couple of silver maples and a couple of honey locusts and a liliodendron and fruit trees and so forth. But in the past couple of years, they've been, especially the honey locusts, have been dropping branches. And, you know, a lot of them are real old, 35 or more years, and very tall. And we're getting worried that they're unstable. And I was wondering what the wisdom is in getting a tree trimmer in, cutting off, you know, 20 or 25 feet from the top of the tree.
Well, we don't... Don't generally recommend taking the top part of the tree off like that. I know mechanically it seems to make sense if we reduce the height. If you're careful about selectively reducing the crown on a tree, especially a younger tree, they do respond well to that. But when you get into a mature tree and you're cutting very large limbs, the tree cannot actively cover over those wounds. And what you're doing is setting it up for long-term failure. So we really try and stay away from what we call practices called topping the tree. So I would want to look at the structure of the tree, and there may be some weight reduction you could do if it's done correctly to help reduce limb drop. There may be some supplemental things such as cables that might help depending on the situation. So, you know, something you need to have an arborist check out, but I would really not recommend topping out a tree like that.
Well, you know, in the past couple of years, we've been getting the trimmers in, you know, and what they normally do is they cut off the lower branches, so it just encourages the tree to grow taller and taller and taller. And
but that's what trees do. I mean, that's...
I'm trying to discourage them from doing that.
I don't know if it encourages. I think the trees is going to do that anyway. But as you say, Pat, topping a tree that is cutting off the leader is not ever recommended. And why is that? And even though they do it, people do it because you've seen, I call it tree mutilation under the power lines. We're going to look back at this era if we survive, and with our power lines and the way we hacked at our trees and say, boy, these people were barbarians. First of all, why did you have these wires all over the place when we find a better way to transmit, you know, put electricity, send it back and forth? And the other is like, and then they hacked their trees. They planted them underneath and they hacked at them. But so it's, you're in a difficult situation there, Ron.
Okay.
Pat, any advice?
Well, get a good arborist in there and explain your concerns. And like I said, you may be able to do some canopy thinning or weight reduction with some of the branches over the house. But Mike's right. The tree wants to grow tall. And if you're going to fight Mother Nature, you're going to set yourself up for problems. So
I think that's a good way to go. Ron, thank you so much for the phone call. I appreciate it.
Okay, thank you.
773-763-9278. Let's go to Sue. You're on the Mike Novak Show. Good morning, Sue.
Oh, hi. Thank you, Mike, and hi to everyone there. My question is, to Dr. Bell is, have you integrated any of the work done by Dr. Doug Tallamy out of the University of Maryland about how trees support insect life? In his book, Bringing Nature Home, he has a list of the number of insects that are supported by different native species. And, for example, oak trees, the oak species support over 500 different types of moths and butterflies. Now, that's the research that he has done. Cherries and willows are enormously beneficial. And with the, you know, insects are just such an important part of our life. We have to have them, even though everybody thinks we don't. So that's my question to Dr. Bell. Have you integrated, and if you have not, then please do, because Norway maple provides absolutely no ecosystem services other than being there.
You know,
and
Sue,
that's all I have to say.
No, Sue, hold on. Don't go away. I understand. Okay. I got some extra information on you. You're a Dundee Township supervisor?
Yes.
What kind of supervision?
I supervise the whole township, and Dundee Township is one of the five townships in the state that has an open space district, which I helped create by being an activist. So in 1997... the voters in our township voted an $18 million bond referendum to buy land to restore as open space. And that's what I'm doing now as a supervisor. We have 860 acres, and I'm restoring it in native vegetation, I and my staff and the many volunteers that I have. And we do a lot of looking at the botanical gardens and researching about, you know, factoring in climate change and also creating habitat with native trees and native other plants.
And I got to thank you for your question, because that was a question I was going to. And see, all my listeners are so smart. They are anticipating what I'm going to ask, because, yeah, Doug Tallamy has been on this program, and he changed my life, basically, by pointing out that one of the things we have to protect is our native insect population, that if we lose insect biomass, that's a chain reaction we don't want to start. And I guess that was part of my question earlier when I talked about native species. And unfortunately, I forgot this part of the equation, Sue, so I thank you for calling. And that is, if we're planting ginkgos and other non-natives, how are we supporting our insect populations in the future? So I'm going to let you go, Sue, and then have Dr. Bell try to answer that. Thank you for calling.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye. What do you think?
Well, I think that the question I heard was, did we integrate any of the work?
Well, that it was part of the question.
Right. And no, this was just to look at the effects of climate change on urban street trees.
But doesn't it occur to you that you need to integrate that work, too? I mean, we can't. And that goes back to the comment that was made earlier about planting natives as well.
Yes, I think it would be a great thing moving forward. I mean, once you finish research, you always see where can we go from here, and that certainly would be a great path to take, I think, from this point. But this was, as I mentioned before, kind of the first of one of its kind studies, and so we just want to look at the effects of climate change.
And that is always a problem with being a first of its kind study. Lots of questions get asked.
Right.
Because of that study.
You create more questions than
right.
you answer.
And I'm not busting you here and saying, well, why don't you know this? I think it's good that we bring this up and we know that it's going to lead to other questions. Mm-hmm. Before we get to our next caller, excuse me, something I just thought about in terms of tree planting, Pat, and that is staking. That's kind of a controversial subject. It didn't used to be, but it kind of is now. And what is your opinion on that when you plant a tree? Some people, I think in the old days, everybody assumed you always staked a tree. And now some arborists and scientists are saying, no, that might not be such a good idea because it doesn't allow a tree to have its own strength. What's your position at the care of trees?
If it's done right, when it's first put in, then staking can be a very valuable tool for helping to get the tree started. You want to keep it loose enough that the tree can move around and, like you're saying, begin to develop taper that it's going to need to kind of stand on its own feet down the road. But if you've got to really anchor that tree in and are planning to leave it there for a long time, you're going to create a tall, skinny, weak tree. So I think initially when the tree's going in, or especially if it's a large tree that had a lot of its roots taken off when it was transplanted.
Well, they all do, don't they, pretty much? I mean, that can be really damaging to a tree to dig it up and then move it someplace else.
Sure.
Studies show that 90% of the roots could be removed.
Mm-hmm. Right. And that's why they don't always grow very quickly right after you plant them, mm-hmm. is they're working on getting the roots back under them if everything's going right.
All right, let's take one more quick phone call, and that's Debbie. You're on the Mike Novak Show. Good morning.
Good morning, Mike. I love your show.
Thank you.
I'm calling this morning about the impact that chemical spraying from above has on trees, because our whole line of homes have crabapple trees planted in front. All of them are bare in the top, and in mid-August, they actually look like we were mid-fall. They're losing leaves. It's been very dry, true. But I've noticed more trees are falling over, and we are being sprayed every day with chemicals like aluminum and barium, and it's just taken a toll on everything across the whole ecology.
Are you? I'm wondering. We don't have a lot of time, Debbie, but let me just ask you, are you talking about chemtrails?
Exactly.
Okay. Chemtrails, as you know, is very controversial. Some people believe there's a conspiracy and that the government is poisoning us on purpose, and other people just don't think that's true. I'm in the latter camp. I think that chemtrails are I don't think the government has time to be that crazy.
I'm not saying it's the government.
Yeah.
I'm just saying that they do exist and they are having an effect on our ecology. And for us to deny or ignore that is to bury our heads in the sand about what's really going on. And you believe in stopping the fracking.
Yep.
This is another dot that has to be connected to the I've heard that Monsanto is developing trees that are spray resistant, and I'm wondering if they're beginning to be brought in and planted. It's just like the GMOs.
Okay, well, we'll have to leave it at that because I got about 30 seconds. So what I would suggest, it seems to me that the crabs are actually suffering from drought. Would you agree with that, Pat?
It could be drought, could be apple leaf scab, could be a few things without looking at them.
Yeah. So those things might be part of the deal, and they, I just not a fan of that conspiracy theory. Gentlemen, thank you so much for being here today. Dr. Andrew Bell from Chicago Botanic Garden, Pat Etherington from the Care of Trees, a Davey company, by the way. Davey, you can call him 800-508-9466 or go to thecareoftrees.com. We're out of here. At this point, I say go green or
go home.